From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I have said, and I say again, that impeachment is off the table.
Well, incoming House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says no to impeachment. A coalition of veterans and anti-war groups are launching a national movement to do just that. We'll speak with former New York Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. She played a key role in the committee investigating Watergate. And we'll speak with Pentagon whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. But first, who voted and why?
African-American turnout was up, and it had a huge impact in three battleground states, Missouri, Virginia, and Rhode Island.
Today, a roundtable discussion on the ethnic, religious, and social makeup of voters in the elections. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Democratic sweep of this year's midterm elections is complete. Republican incumbent George Allen has conceded Virginia's Senate race to challenger James Webb, giving Democrats control of both houses of Congress. Allen gave his concession speech on Thursday.
The Bible teaches us that there's a time and place for everything. And today, I've called and congratulated Jim Webb and his team for their victory. They had the prevailing winds.
The election fallout continues to hit the Republican Party. On Thursday, Republican officials announced Republican National Committee Chair Ken Mellman will step down at the end of the year. Mellman's departure comes one day after Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The New York Times reports the Bush administration has been considering Rumsfeld's removal since the summer, but postponed action in part to avoid emboldening critics before the midterm elections. At the White House, President Bush met with Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi Thursday in their first meeting since the election. In an earlier sit-down with his cabinet, the president laid out his top goals for Congress.
First order of business is for Congress to complete the work on the federal spending bills for this year with strong fiscal discipline and without diminishing our capacity to fight the war on terror. Another important priority in the war on terror is for the Congress to pass the Terrorist Surveillance Act. We also need to pass the bipartisan energy legislation that's now before Congress.
The president also called on Congress to approve U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, but new developments indicate he will run into difficulty. On Thursday, Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island said he would continue to oppose Bolton's nomination. Chafee leaves Congress in January after losing his bid for re-election. Chafee said, quote, "The American people have spoken out against the president's agenda on a number of fronts, and presumably one of those is on foreign policy. I'm not going to endorse something the American people have spoken out against." Without Chafee's vote, Republicans will likely fall short of moving Bolton's nomination out of committee to the full Senate. Meanwhile, Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi spoke after meeting with President Bush.
It is very exciting to be the first woman Speaker of the House, God willing, if my colleagues support that in another few days. And as Speaker, I understand my responsibility, Speaker of the House, of all of the House, not just the Democrats, and the responsibility to work with the administration to make progress for the American people.
Pelosi's meeting with the president comes as Democrats are already preparing their list of committee chairs. Democratic Party officials said Thursday Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut will chair the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. Lieberman won as an independent after losing the Democratic primary to Ned Lamont. In Iraq, the number of U.S. troops this month has reached 23. The military announced today the deaths of three U.S. service members. Meanwhile, Iraq's health minister, Ali al-Shamari, said insurgents have been responsible for the deaths of around 150,000 Iraqis since the U.S.-led invasion. He did not say how he obtained the figure. Shamari also said the violence could be controlled if the U.S. Army left Iraqi cities and handed full control to Iraq. He said, quote, "The Army of America didn't do its job. They tie the hands of my government. They should hand us the power. We are a sovereign country," he said. In the Gaza Strip, tens of thousands of people crowded a cemetery in Beit Hanun Thursday for the burial of 16 family members and two others killed in an Israeli attack on their homes. Seven of the dead Adhana family members were children, including an 18-month-old girl. Six other victims were women. Another 19 family members were wounded, including four children who lost limbs. At the UN Thursday, Palestinian observer Riyad Mansour said Israel had committed, quote, state terrorism.
These are war crimes for which the perpetrators must be held accountable under international law. What we have seen today and in recent days and months, the blood of Palestinian civilians flowing in the streets, the demolition of their homes, and their constant humiliation, suffering, and collective punishment, is exactly what the Palestinian people have been subjected to under nearly 39 years of Israeli belligerence.
Hours after the funerals, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said the attack was a result of a technical failure with military radar. Olmert said Israel regrets the killings but refused to rule out further shelling of the Gaza Strip. The government's actions are coming under growing criticism inside Israel. An editorial in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz says, quote, no excuse can justify this atrocity. When artillery batteries aim their shells near a residential neighborhood, such a disaster is inevitable. The United Nations is warning millions of people are at risk without major initiative from leading nations on the world's water crisis. This is Kevin Watkins of the UN Development Program.
There are over 1 billion people in the world who do not have access to clean water. These are people who start their day walking to rivers to collect water, sending young girls to collect water, and so on. There are over 2.6 billion people in the world who do not have access to sanitation. These twin deficits, I think, do speak to a global crisis.
The UN is calling on industrialized countries to raise annual aid to poorer countries by at least $4 billion. In Mexico, leaders of the massive protests in the state of Oaxaca are seeking refuge in the Catholic Church amid increased threats to their lives. On Wednesday, unidentified assailants accosted several protesters on the streets. The protesters are in the sixth month of a struggle to unseat the unpopular Oaxacan governor Ulises Ruiz. This is Flavio Sosa, leader of the Popular People's Assembly of Oaxaca.
The local hierarchy has a commitment to the people of Oaxaca. We hope that this commitment transforms itself into humanitarian support, because we are not asking for either economic or financial support, just humanitarian support.
In other news from Mexico City, has approved a measure to legalize same-sex civil unions. The legislation allows several rights, but stops short of granting gay couples the right of full marriage or child adoption. In Sri Lanka, a renewal of violence is leading to fears the country could see its worst fighting in 4 years. Earlier today, a leading Tamil politician was assassinated near his home in Colombo. Nadaraja Raviraj was a member of the parliament with the Tamil National Alliance. His death comes 2 days after government forces killed at least 23 people and wounded dozens more in the shelling of a camp for displaced refugees. This is Dr. M. Devaraj, director of a local hospital.
All these are due to blast injury. According to the patient's story, they say they were in refugee camp, school, and some were in home. So they injured due to the blast or shell artillery injury. Now there are more than 15 patients in critically ill.
An estimated 40,000 people have been displaced by fighting between the Sri Lankan military and the Tamil Tiger rebels over the past several days. Back in the United States, the Bush administration has lifted a military training ban on 11 Latin American and Caribbean countries amidst concerns over a string of recent victories by left-wing candidates in the hemisphere. The victories include Nicaragua, where Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega was elected president this week. USA Today reports the administration hopes the renewed training will help reverse the growing wave of opposition to U.S. policies. The ban was initially imposed 4 years ago on countries that refused to sign waivers granting immunity to the U.S. military before the International Criminal Court. In other news, four activists connected to the Environmental Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front pleaded guilty Thursday to a series of arsons in the Pacific Northwest. Daniel McGowan, Joanna Zacher, Nathan Block, and Jonathan Paul reached a plea bargain with the government where they took responsibility for the crimes on the condition they would never have to snitch on anyone involved in the movement. The four had been facing sentences as severe as life plus over 1,000 years in prison. Six other activists have already pleaded guilty and are cooperating with prosecutors. According to their attorneys, the four could still face over 20 years because the government considers the arsons a form of terrorism. This is Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon.
These acts of arson are no different than any other run-of-the-mill arson crime, the only difference being that these defendants based their acts on the simple fact that the crimes were motivated by a desire to end animal suffering and to prevent continued environmental destruction. But for their strongly held, principled beliefs, we probably wouldn't be facing this terrorism enhancement, which can add up to 20 years to their sentences.
After the court hearing Thursday, federal prosecutors claim the Northwest cells of the Environmental Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front have now been effectively dismantled. In California, two Los Angeles police officers are under investigation after video surfaced showing them repeatedly beating a man as he lay on the ground. The man, William Cardenas, is held down and punched in the face as he yells, "I can't breathe." The footage was posted on the website YouTube.com. And finally, Ed Bradley has died. The award-winning journalist was best known for his 26 years as a correspondent on 60 Minutes. He joined the program after notable stints reporting from Vietnam and as CBS's first African-American correspondent at the White House. Just last month, Ed Bradley aired the first interview with the accused members of the Duke lacrosse team. Bradley also had the only televised interview with Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. On Thursday, CBS News aired this tribute from correspondent Byron Pitts.
I knew Ed Bradley. We weren't really friends. He was more like a father. And in this world, for people who look like me, father figures are a very big deal. I remember the first time I saw Ed on TV, in the water with those women and children. That story hit me the same way it probably hit a lot of African-American children in the 1970s. Wow, there's someone on TV who looks like me. And today there are thousands of journalists working hard because Ed Bradley showed us you can do this. Tonight and tomorrow night and for days thereafter, I will thank the good Lord Ed Bradley lived and that we all had a chance to learn from him. I promise, Ed, we did.
Byron Pitts of CBS News. Ed Bradley was 65 years old. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. Today we take a look at who voted and why. Voter turnout for Tuesday's election was one of the highest for a midterm election in recent years. It is estimated that over 40% of eligible voters cast ballots in an election that gave Democrats control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 12 years. Democrats also gained six governorships and 300 state legislative seats around the country. Exit polls are showing significant shifts in voting patterns among the electorate. Democrats succeeded in winning back some religious voters who had voted solidly Republican in the last few elections. And for the first time since 1996, a majority of Florida Latinos voted Democrat. Young voters had a huge increase in turnout, with 2 million more young people voting on Tuesday than in 2002. And African-American voters turned out, the African-American voter turnout made the difference in tight races like Missouri and Virginia.
Today, a roundtable discussion on the ethnic, religious, and social makeup of voters in these elections. Tom Perriello is with us, senior advisor and co-founder of the Catholic Alliance for the Common Good, joining us in our Firehouse studio here in New York. And in Washington, D.C., at Reuters, we're joined by Kathleen Barr and Kirk Clay. Kathleen Barr is the media coordinator for Young Voter Strategies. Her group was involved in registering 500,000 new young voters. And Kirk Clay is director of the Electoral College Reform Project at Common Cause, Prior to that, he was deputy director of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. Common Cause is a member of that group. On the line from San Antonio, Texas, we're joined by Lydia Camarillo. She's the vice president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Kirk Clay, director of the Electoral College Reform Project at Common Cause, give us your assessment of the elections. And in terms of the African-American vote, how key was it this week?
The African-American vote was huge this week. In terms of turnout, without the African-American vote, the Democrats would not have won three of the Senate seats. When we look at the actual numbers, and I'm going to go through my stats here to make sure that I get them correct for you. In terms of the Senate, the most critical numbers in Virginia, African Americans were 16% of the vote share, and 85% of the African Americans voted for the Democrat. The Democrat, though, had only won 51% of the vote. And on the other hand, Webb only received 42% of the white vote. So that's almost 55% of the white vote went for Allen. And so without the African Americans turning out in huge numbers and voting for the Democratic candidate, that race would have gone the other way. And remember, we're talking about red states here. I mean, you know, so this is absolutely huge. In Missouri, the Democrat won with 51% of the vote. And white voters supported the Republican candidate by 55%. So African Americans were 13% of the vote share there, and they voted 91% for McCaskill. And then the shocker of the evening, in Rhode Island, Democrat White House won with 53% of the total vote. He only received 50% of the white vote. He received 85% of the African American vote, and they made up 5% of the vote share. So just with those numbers, you can tell that you know, African American turnout not only was large, but also it made the difference in a couple of those races. And later on, I can talk a little bit about House races. There's actually five other House races, including Tom DeLay's old district, where African Americans made up 22% of the district, and they helped to push some of these numbers over the top.
Well, Kirk Clay, a couple of years ago in the presidential election, there was some indication that a larger percentage of African Americans had voted for President Bush than many had expected. What is your sense of how the African American vote throughout the country fared in terms of shifting back to the Democratic Party? And was the possibility of the whole situation with the handling of Katrina, did that have any kind of impact on the vote?
You know, but you hit the nail on the head. I would not say that African Americans went to the polls with Katrina at the forefront of their mind. But what Katrina did was it caused not just African Americans, but I believe independents and the rest of the electorate to really start to focus on political issues and whether or not the administration and not just the president's administration, but also Congress as a whole, was handling things competently. And as people started to focus and listen and pay attention to what was coming out of Washington, that sort of caused them to think a little more about the issues that were coming out. So they really focused a lot sooner than what they usually would. I mean, we all know that usually in an election, people don't really pick up the paper and start to focus until maybe 2 weeks out, you know. Sometimes it's the weekend before. But this year, I believe, right after Katrina, people started to look and see, well, wait a second, you know, something's wrong here. I know, for example, African Americans did not see closure in what happened with Katrina. And I think many of the other independents just did not see closure. I mean, you know, we all saw a couple of really good photo ops. But in terms of answering the question, you know, how did this happen and how do we keep this from happening again, we never saw that. So
we're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Kirk Clay is with Common Cause. We'll also speak with Lydia Camarillo, vice president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. We'll look at the religious vote as well with a new organization that deals with Catholics and other religions. And we'll be talking about the youth vote. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
You better watch and think about yourself. Be careful how you vote, y'all.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk about the vote, we turn to Tom Perriello, senior advisor and co-founder of Catholic Alliance for the Common Good. Juan?
Well, Tom, I'd like to ask you, as a former longtime altar boy, I was most surprised by the apparent shift in the Catholic vote, which had been for the several decades now increasingly Republican, but there was a major shift. Could you talk about that?
Sure. It was quite a dramatic shift. The Democrats did win the Catholic vote after a 12-year or a 25-year decline, depending on which way you look at it. And what was even more interesting was in the key battleground states like Ohio, you saw a 20-point swing in the Catholic vote in some key races. And I think there were a number of factors contributing to this. One was a shift of what people considered the most urgent moral issues. When we were looking at exit polls, corruption was really the leading issue among Catholic voters this year, and they saw it as a choice between corruption and the common good. You saw 75% of voters saying that corruption was very important to them as an issue. Poverty. In six of the key states, you had minimum wage ballot initiatives that passed by an average margin of 31 points in these states. I think Katrina, that you were talking about a moment ago, put these issues on the forefront as moral questions, and the Iraq War. I think the besides the shift in the issue priorities, another thing happened, which was a group of mainstream Catholics have risen up to try to challenge some on the extreme right over what constitutes the fullness of Catholic teaching. Catholic social teaching has a strong tradition on issues of poverty and peace and health care, talking about a community of the common good. And I think those groups were organized. They got into the media, they got into parishes and the communities, and were able to reach people and have a more constructive and robust moral dialogue.
The exit polls also seem to indicate that the evangelical Christian vote, which was expected by some to decline because of demoralization, actually did not, that there was actually about the same percentage of the electorate was evangelical Christian as in the past, but that in the case of Catholics and Jewish voters and others and mainline Protestants, that there was apparently a much bigger shift.
Well, first of all, I think there's a myth that the religious right is trying to put out there right now, which is that their voters didn't show up, and that's why this shift occurred. But the statistics don't back that up. As you mentioned, the number of evangelicals, the percentage of evangelicals actually went up. The problem is they simply didn't listen to the religious right leaders about what the moral issues were in this election. So evangelicals showed up and gave a 12-point swing towards the Democrats or away from the Republicans, depending on how one looks at it. And you see issues within the evangelical community, again, of poverty, of climate change, and very much of clean government resonating with people. I think the era of the 1980s and 1990s, where the moral discussion was about no government, has changed into a discussion about good government and clean government. In the wake of Katrina, in the wake of 9/11 and Enron, people are interested in holding their government accountable and having a government that guarantees the basic human dignity of all people. So yes, with the evangelical vote, you did see people show up. You saw them switching, not a massive wave, but a substantial one that I think is interesting to look at going forward.
Big shift of Jewish voters from Republican to Democrat?
Not a big shift. For the last two election cycles, in 2000 and 2004, there's been a perception, there's been a major investment among Republicans in trying to break away a significant chunk of the Jewish vote. That has not been successful so far. You have not seen a substantial shift. It's remained relatively steady nationwide.
We turn now to our guest in studio in Washington, D.C., talking about the youth vote. Kathleen Barr is media coordinator for Young Voter Strategies. What about this massive increase in the number of young voters?
Yes, Tuesday was a banner election for young voters. For the second major election in a row, 18 to 29-year-olds increased their voter turnout. In 2002, 8 million 18 to 29-year-olds cast ballots, and on Tuesday, we saw 10 million 18 to 29-year-olds go to the polls, so there was a 2 million vote increase. That, with the 2004 election, where we saw a significant uptick in the young voter turnout as well, shows that this is a trend of increasing voter participation among young adults, and that it's a very important part of the electorate for politicians to pay attention to and begin to really reach out to and turn out on Election Day.
One of the things that struck me by some of the exit polls I saw was the enormous percentage of young voters that were voting Democratic. I think some polls even showed it at 60% or higher. The largest pro-Democratic vote of any age group.
That's correct. We saw from the national exit poll that 60% of 18 to 29-year-olds cast their ballots in the congressional races for the Democratic candidate and 38% for the Republican candidate, which is a shift from 2004 when the Democrats had a 10-point advantage. Now they've got, according to the exit poll, about a 22-point advantage. And we see from polling that Young Voter Strategies did with a bipartisan team of pollsters that the number one thing young voters were looking for in the Tuesday elections was change. 43% of 18 to 29-year-olds said that Iraq was the most important issue when deciding for whom to vote on Tuesday. And then in addition to that, the cost of college and education, as well as jobs in the economy, were crucial issues for young voters, and that primarily they were looking for change on Tuesday.
Kathleen, your group alone registered many, many new young voters. What are the strategies you use to do that?
In 2006, Young Voter Strategies, we funded and coordinated 15 nonpartisan organizations across the country to register just over 500,000 18 to 29-year-olds. We used a variety of different strategies as well as targeting different subsets of the youth vote. So, for example, we worked with Women's Voices Women Vote, who registered just over 33,000 single young women, worked with Black Youth Vote, that focused on registering young African American voters, primarily in the South and also in Michigan.
And did you take different strategies for each? Mm-hmm. I mean, where did you go to find people, and how did you register them?
About half of the groups focused on college campuses, registering college students across the country. Other organizations, like the Center for Civic Participation in Michigan, did community-based organizing, went to urban churches in the Detroit area, also went door-to-door in communities focused on African-American communities as well as Arab-American, finding really that personal outreach to young voters is a great way to get them involved in the political process. And then we also worked with organizations that used innovative new technologies like online social networks and text messaging to reach out to young voters that are essentially constantly connected either through the internet or their cell phones, and really was the kind of forefront of using those technologies for voter mobilization.
I'd like to turn now to Lydia Camarillo, who is joining us by telephone from San Antonio, Vice President of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lydia.
Good morning.
Lydia, I'd like to ask you, in the 2 years ago in the presidential elections, again, a lot was made of the inroads that Republicans made into the Latino vote, some estimates of 40-45% support for President Bush among Latinos. What happened this time?
Well, let me just first tell you that since I'm going to be citing the William C. Velasquez Institute exit poll numbers for this year's election turnout, I want to also qualify that in 2004, Latinos voted at 35% for Bush, unlike what the other polling organizations were citing. In fact, NBC had to indicate that it was less than, it was 40%, not 44%, which is what they had originally said. Basically, what we're seeing is that Latinos, like the rest of the country, were upset, dissatisfied. In fact, nationally, and on that poll question, about 66% said they were very much dissatisfied. 20% said they were satisfied. And the interesting one that looked, because what William C. Velasquez did, our sister organization in its polling, is that in addition to doing a national exit poll, it also looked at California, Florida, and Texas independently. And Florida seemed to be at a little higher number at 68% dissatisfied, of which those numbers, when asked about whether the troops should be brought home, nationally, Latinos said 61% should be bring them home next year. Florida and Texas, Texas and California stated 59% and Florida at 57%. And when you asked the question about how did they vote Democratic for the congressional districts, nationally, they voted at 68.9% with California and Florida at 64% and Texas at 63%.
And in terms of voter participation, the turnout rates, how did it look this time?
Well, more than a million Latinos voted this year compared to 2002. And if we look at state by state, similar to what the African-American community was able to do in the East and in the South, I can tell you that in places like Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, New Mexico, and, of course, Texas and some of the other key states where the Democrats gained their seats, Latinos were the significant population. In Texas, you would think that it's such a red state, and you didn't see the shift. Certainly, Latinos were voting for Perry at a significant rate. But when you look at Texas, you saw not only that delay took the delay seat was lost, and Latinos played a major role in that. But you also saw that Dallas, which is considered a stronghold Republican, there were Latinos overwhelmingly voted, and it became a Democratic state. In fact, the headline, the Democratic county, you saw the same thing with the state gaining 5 state rep seats. California, the seat, California 11, the CD 11, Pomo seat, no one expected that seat to go. It went by 5,000 votes with Latinos over making a good section, majority of those voting Latinos voting against Pomo. So what you saw is the same sort of wave or earthquake, which is what I hear we're seeing, that Latinos were feeling a dissatisfaction with the way the country was going, and particularly the issues were similar. Latinos are against the war. Clearly, the immigration question became an important question for them, as was poverty and environment and corruption, I think, sort of took everything over the top. But Latinos were dissatisfied. They overwhelmingly voted Democrat, and they turned out in record numbers. And they basically were able to follow and be consistent with the call by the communities against issues that were clearly anti-Latino, anti-American in their sense, similar to what happened with the immigration reform call and the marches.
I wanted to go back to Kirk Clay and ask about the role, for example, in Virginia, such a key state, the Senator George Allen just admitting defeat yesterday, the whole issue of both, you know, calling this young person of color who was filming him saying, welcome to America, calling him macaca, the former college teammate of Allen saying, named Kendall Shelton, saying that Allen had nicknamed him the wizard because his name was similar to the local imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and that saying that Allen and a third friend shot a deer while hunting, that Allen cut the deer's head off, asked directions to the nearest black person's home, and then shoved the head into that person's oversized mailbox. What effect did that have in Virginia?
Well, you know, oddly enough, for African Americans, this is sad to say, but, you know, we've seen these kinds of politics, especially in a red state like Virginia. I mean, I we do need to look at this. I mean, we're talking about the South. We're talking about a state that at one point refused to open their public schools, because integration was being enforced. So we sort of, I mean, that wasn't, it was an issue because we understood it, but a lot of people in our community had known a lot of these things a long time ago. You know, when he was first running for office, we knew that this guy, you know, had a noose, in his office at one point, and that, you know, this guy used to walk around with the Confederate flag pin. So some of these issues we had already known. But even more importantly, you know, the bigger story now is people like Barack Obama. Think about this. I mean, you know, here's an African-American guy, you know, most people can barely say his name. And, he was a rock star. I mean, you know, he traveled to both red states and blue states. I mean, he campaigned hard in Virginia. He campaigned hard in Maryland. I mean, he did a tremendous job. Even Harold Ford. I mean, and some of the things that happened to him, you know, which is so disappointing for us, we have to do better in places like Tennessee. I mean, campaigning like that in airing ads like that, you know, very nasty, partisan ads like that, you know, that's just not the way to go. But that is the positive thing. And then also in terms of, you know, this election was a historic time for African Americans. You see people like Deval Patrick in Massachusetts, right? You know, he will become the first governor of Massachusetts. And he's only, though, the second governor since Reconstruction. Right, African Americans made up about 9% of the vote share in Massachusetts, but that shows that you know we're making wonderful gains in some places, but then we still have a long way to go other places.
Kirkley, I'd like to ask you in terms of the issue of voter suppression. We had an interesting race right here in the suburbs of New York, in Westchester County, at a state Senate seat where a woman, Andrea Stewart Cousins, won in a large majority white district. African American woman defeated an entrenched Republican, but there was a lot of voter suppression at the polls, and thousands of voter registrations right. challenged by the Republican lawyers in the weeks before the election. What are you hearing in terms of still problems of voter suppression of minority voters around the country?
Oh, it's absolutely huge. It's not just for African Americans. It's also for Latinos. I mean, we saw in California, you know, with those letters going out in that congressional district. And really, it's voter suppression through misdirection, which is very interesting. You know, it's an interesting sort of a turn. You know, we've seen that in the 2004 election, but specifically what I saw this year was the night before the election. There were flyers being mailed to African Americans in Maryland. Right. And this is not just a black or white thing. I mean, this has to do with I don't want to say party, but, you know, maybe it is people with a certain political bent, because Michael Steele. Right. And Ehrlich were a part of, or alleged to be. I cannot say that, you know, the investigation is going to find out that they were at the bottom of this. But their faces was on a voter's guide that at the top of the voter's guide, it said something like support our Democrat candidates. And then on the voter's guide, it lists Kwesi Mfume as being in support of Michael Steele and Ehrlich, and also a couple of other African-American prominent leaders in Prince George's County. And when they looked at the actual mail codes, they saw that, you know, that letter did have to do did come from someone from one of their campaigns. So the investigation is still going on. But my point is, we've seen these kinds of tactics before, and it's just so nasty. At some point, we're going to have to get to a place in politics where we don't use race to either give people a positive advantage or give people a negative disadvantage. And until we do that, democracy is going to be failing some of our people.
Kirk Antom, you also had a first in Keith Ellison in Minneapolis.
Both yes.
The first non-white representative being sent to Washington and the first Muslim
yes.
Congress member to go to Washington.
Yes, yes. And that is a wonderful, wonderful feat. And his district was, I think, barely 7% African American, if I'm not mistaken. So we're making tremendous gains, you know, and we're very, very proud of that. And also in terms of statewide, I mean, we've won 6 statewide seats. David Patterson in New York, Lieutenant Governor. Anthony Brown in Maryland, Lieutenant Governor. He had 23% of the vote share from African Americans in Maryland. Denise Nader here will be the state treasurer in Connecticut. In Illinois, Jesse White. He received 10% of the vote share in Illinois, and then he will be the next second. Well, he continued to be the Secretary of State there. So we've made tremendous gains, and I'm very, very proud of what African Americans were able to do. And we will be rewarded. I mean, you know, there's 4 chairmanships up at the House. Nancy Pelosi will be the speaker, but Rangel will be the Ways and Means chair, Conyers the chair of the judiciary, Benny Thompson, chair of Homeland Security, and Juanita Milner McDonald heading up operations. So finally, you know, we see a point at which African Americans can stick their chest out and be proud. You know, but I hasten that this democracy still needs a lot of work, and so we will go back to work and roll up our sleeves for the next election cycle just to make sure that we do some real election reform to help make sure that these problems don't hinder us.
Tom Perriello.
2 quick points on that in terms of the victory in Minnesota. First of all, one of the encouraging things about this new resurgent progressive faith movement is that it is interfaith. And we're finding that the issues that matter to people of faith cross denominations and cross religions. Issues like poverty, clean government, peace are issues that we see resonating regardless of the particular religious denomination of the people running. And I think that's one of the powers of this new movement, is that people are eager for that, not something that divides us but brings us together on our highest values. I think a second thing that's important to point out, we've heard a lot about how the African American and Latino vote was crucial in some of these swing states. The Catholic vote swung 15 points in Virginia and 25 points in Montana. And I mention this because I think when you put these numbers together, you get a key lesson from this election. One of the things people are saying that I think is incorrect is that the Democrats won this election by running a bunch of conservatives and by running a bunch of moderates. If you actually look at who it was that was swinging in this vote, it was actually that there was massive turnout of a lot of people who are motivated by some of the deepest principles of progressive thinking, even in the red states. What you had was, for example, people like Ted Strickland and Sherrod Brown essentially ran as what one person called ethical populists. You had people who were raised not running to the middle, but actually running to their principles. And what we found with religious voters is that they care much more about right and wrong than about right and left, which means that you can have some centrist candidates who do well, but you can also have some very progressive candidates that by sticking to their values, they actually gain more than they would by running to the middle. Tim Kaine won as governor in Virginia last year, which is my home state, by opposing the death penalty in a pro-death penalty state, because people cared a lot more about him standing for his principles than they cared about the issue. So I think when you look at the groups that really helped swing this vote, we've got to be, the Democrats should be very wary of understanding who delivered this. So when they set the agenda for Congress, issues like the minimum wage, issues like health care and a new direction for Iraq are going to be key if they want to lock in and sustain some of the victories they saw this
year. Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank everyone for being with us. Tom Perriello, senior advisor and co-founder of Catholic Alliance for the Common Good, Kathleen Barr in Washington, D.C., media coordinator for the Young Voter Strategies, and joining us from San Antonio, Texas, Lydia Camarillo, vice president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, as well as Kirk Clay, director of the Electoral College Reform Project at Common Cause. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, former Congress member Elizabeth Holtzman and Pentagon whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Let's impeach the president, Neil Young, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
On Saturday, a coalition of groups are meeting near Independence Hall in Philadelphia to announce plans to mobilize a national movement to impeach President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Groups backing the effort include Progressive Democrats of America, Code Pink, Gold Star Families for Peace, and Veterans for Peace. While the pro-impeachment movement has received little media attention, polls show growing numbers support for Congress to take such action. A recent Newsweek poll found 51% of all Americans, including 20% of Republicans, feel impeachment should be on the table. But it appears the new Democrat-led Congress will not take up the issue. Nancy Pelosi, who is set to become House Speaker, was asked about it on Wednesday during her first press conference since the midterm election.
Democrats are not about getting even. Democrats are about helping the American people get ahead. And that's what our agenda is about. So while some people are excited about prospects that they have in terms of their priorities, they are not our priorities. I have said, and I say again, that impeachment is off the table.
There is support for impeachment in the House. Over three dozen Democrats in Congress have publicly supported an inquiry into possible impeachable offenses by the Bush administration. The list includes John Conyers of Michigan, positioned to become chair of the House Judiciary Committee. To talk more about impeachment, the midterm elections, and the war in Iraq, we're joined by two guests, Elizabeth Holtzman and Daniel Ellsberg. Elizabeth Holtzman served four terms in Congress, where she played a key role in House impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon. She's co-author of the new book, The Impeachment of George W. Bush, A Practical Guide for Concerned Citizens. Welcome to Democracy Now! You're going to be speaking at a pro-impeachment rally on Saturday in Philadelphia?
Correct. In an effort to try to bring create a grassroots movement around the country and press Congress to do what should be done.
What's your response to the speaker-in-waiting, Nancy Pelosi, saying it's off the table?
Well, it's very understandable. It was off the table to the Democrats in 1973, when the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, and you had Richard Nixon as president.
He had won by a landslide victory in 72.
Correct. He'd won by a landslide, and impeachment was off the table then. No Democrat was pushing for it. And, in fact, as the revelations came out, it still wasn't on the table. It took the American people, after the Saturday night massacre, sending a clear message to
Saturday
the Congress.
Saturday night massacre being?
The firing by Richard Nixon of the special prosecutor who was investigating him. It took that clear signal from the American people, who said enough is enough. We are not a banana republic. A president cannot be above the law. He cannot stop an investigation into possible criminal behavior by him or his top aides. And we want Congress to hold him accountable. So it came from the American people. It didn't come from the Congress. It's understandable that congressional leaders, members of Congress, will be very reluctant to take this enormous step to protect our Constitution and our democracy. But the American people, still, we have a democracy. You saw what happened at the polls. Members of Congress will get it if the American people want it.
Of course, in the Clinton scandal, it wasn't the demand that came from the American people for impeachment. It was one that came directly from the Congress itself. And, and of course, that was the level of alleged crimes there was certainly not at the level that we're talking about here.
Well, remember, under the Constitution, first of all, you don't need a crime to commit an impeachable offense. It doesn't have to be a crime. A high crime and misdemeanor is really an archaic British term that means an abuse of power. It's a political offense, not a criminal offense. President Clinton did very bad things, but they were not abuses of power. They did not threaten our democracy, and the American people got it. They understand what impeachment's about. And that's why they, in the end, supported the impeachment of Richard Nixon, because what he was doing was involved an abuse of power. What he was saying was that he was above the law, and the American people said, no, we don't want that kind of abuse of our democracy. And I think the same thing can happen again. Of course, you can't have a top-down impeachment. You can't have a partisan impeachment. If an impeachment happens, it has to be done, I think, the way we did it in Watergate, which was bipartisan, to include the American people, to have a process that was extremely fair. Nobody could question the fairness of it.
Explain how it worked, because Nixon resigned. He wasn't impeached.
Nixon resigned because the process was so fair and so thorough and so honorable that he was going to have no support. Maybe one or two people would have voted for him to stay on as president in the House, and maybe one or two people would have voted for him in the Senate. He had lost all support in the Congress, and that's why a delegation of top Republican leaders, including Barry Goldwater, went to see Richard Nixon and told him, you have no support in the House or the Senate. You can go through an impeachment trial. You will be surely impeached in the House, and you will be surely removed from the Senate. Because what happened was, all the members, our first vote on the House Judiciary Committee was a bipartisan vote. We had members of the Republicans as well as Democrats, including very conservative Democrats, voting for impeachment. Then the smoking gun tape was released by order of the Supreme Court. That's a tape that showed that Richard Nixon from the get-go had ordered the cover-up and obstruction of justice. And once that tape came out, every Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, even those who initially voted against impeachment, said he has committed impeachable offenses. So
let me ask you, John Conyers, who would head the House Judiciary Committee, certainly is not one who is afraid to begin these kinds of investigations. What was the relationship in the House Judiciary Committee then between the chairs there and the leadership?
Well, it was first the American people that galvanized Congress into action that lit that fire. That's what happened. The House Judiciary Committee, the leadership had a key decision to make. Was it going to be the House Judiciary Committee that undertook this, or was there going to be a special select committee? That was the first, I think, strategic and important decision. They said, okay, it's going to the Judiciary Committee, because if we create a special committee, the American people will say we have stacked the cards. We're going to take the existing committee and use that committee. And that's the committee that, warts and all, brand new members and all, that was the committee that was given this assignment. But I never was given any instruction from any member of the leadership or by the chair of the committee as to how to vote.
Nancy Pelosi would be president. She's third in line.
Correct.
That is, if President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney were impeached. But what are you talking about when it comes to Vice President Dick Cheney?
Well, my view right now is that I'm not sure we have the overwhelming evidence. That's not to say he hasn't committed impeachable offenses, just that we don't have the same kind of level of evidence that we have with respect to President Bush. On the illegal wiretaps, for example, it's President Bush who repeatedly and admittedly signed these orders directing wiretaps in violation of the explicit language of the statute. We don't have Dick Cheney signing that. I mean, that's a very good example of how we have President Bush, but we don't see President Cheney's fingerprints. That's not to say he wasn't part and parcel of this, but we don't see that.
We're talking to former Congress member Elizabeth Holtzman, who's written a book on impeachment. Daniel Ellsberg is also with us, perhaps the country's best-known whistleblower, leaked to the press the Pentagon Papers, the 7,000-page top-secret study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam that set in motion actions that would eventually topple Nixon. He recently published an article in Harper's Magazine about Iran. It's called The Next War. How do you tie this in, what your campaign is now, which is not exactly impeachment, Daniel Ellsberg?
I think the impeachment process, starting with investigations, is very important, but it's not the only important thing right now. Actually, Maurice Hinchey introduced a bill on June 20th this year calling for Congress to cut off any funds, to deny any funds in the appropriation bills for an attack on Iran, unless that had followed, as in Article 1, Section 8, from a decision by Congress. And it was a very brief little discussion on the night of June 20th. 2 hours later, there was a vote. He had 158 votes in favor of that, somewhat surprisingly. That is the way the Vietnam War was stopped. I don't think they'll stop the Iraq War very quickly that way. It takes a long time for a congressman to face the charge that he's taking away money from the troops, no matter how long and whether they should be there or not. But the Iran War has not yet started, and a measure to prevent it before it starts has, I think, a lot more promise. And I think that approach with a new Congress has real promise. But even so, you'd need, I think, a crucial aspect of that would be information from inside the government, and this applies both to the impeachment process and to measures like this. If you rely entirely on the administration cooperating by providing the documents you're asking or the witnesses you're asking, that's not going to happen. They've promised already, I think it's Cheney who said, a cataclysmic fight to the death. before they will let these documents get out. Now, a process like that is what finally emboldened Congress or enraged Congress to the point where, in fact, they did begin to cut off the funds for the war, and they did seriously begin to look at impeachment. If the president was going to totally subordinate their role and rule it out of the Constitution, essentially, that finally got their backs up. That could happen here. As investigations start on a variety of reasons, which should happen, including Cheney, you'll get the facts on the table from leakers. The facts you'll get will be unauthorized. And now an unauthorized disclosure leak has a chance of being acted on by Congress, which in the last several years, people have gotten discouraged. They've put out the truth to Cy Hirsch and to others, and we can all see not much happens. Congress, the Republican committees are not interested in hearing that. They don't want to act on it. Now it's a challenge. If somebody inside the government gives information either on criminal wrongdoing by their bosses, which bears directly, or, you know, terrible high crimes and misdemeanors, which bears directly on impeachment, if they give that to Congress and the press, Congress now led by the Democrats, cannot just ignore it, at least not if we let them. We can demand that that they do act on it, so, and that's a great inducement to get.
What you're saying is, in essence, that another Daniel Ellsberg is needed, and then maybe even another John Dean to come forward from the inner circle.
Both of those and more are needed, and we need them in a more timely way than either of us did it. Dean knew about the burglary of my psychiatrist's office years before he revealed it under pressure. I knew about what was happening in Nixon years before I finally saw the light that it had to be given not only to Congress, which was sitting on it, but to the press. And I'm sorry it took that long. But when it comes to impeachment, say, I have a full disclosure here to make. It was crimes that Nixon did against me, in part we learned by leaking, that were a major part of the impeachment process that you were looking at, that he was committing those crimes. If Dean had not revealed them in order to cop a plea himself in the process, had not told the truth, they would not have called other people back to the grand jury and discovered they had enough basis for an impeachment. And likewise, if I hadn't put the documents out, Nixon wouldn't have been so afraid of me as to commit the crimes, to shut me up. I don't suppose I've made Bush as afraid of me then, I'm sorry to say. If he has committed crimes against me, I don't know them yet. If I've been listened in on warrantless wiretaps, I imagine I have, but it may be a while before I learn it. But there are others who could supply the names of which Specter was not able to get from the president. Republican, head of the Judiciary Committee, was not able to get the names or even the programs. There are people in NSA who could tell him that. And if a Democrat now wants to hear that, which Specter didn't, he can call those people, he can put them under oath, and he can hear their testimony. People like Sybil Edmonds, Russell Tice, and people in NSA who know the crimes that have been committed.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon whistleblower, calling for whistleblowers today to come out, especially around plans for Iran, and former Congressmember Liz Holtzman. She has written a new book. It's called The Impeachment of George W. Bush, A Practical Guide for Concerned Citizens. She'll be speaking on Saturday in Philadelphia at a pro-impeachment rally this Veterans Day weekend. I'll be in San Francisco on Saturday, 11 o'clock, at the Green Fest, which is at San Francisco Concourse Exhibition Center on Brannan Street, then in Fort Bragg, California, on Saturday night, and then San Luis Obispo on Sunday. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, co-produced John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, your Rich and Aramate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio. Thank you. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.